I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Jag tycker ju den här studien är magisk, för man intervjuar aktiva fondförvaltare som förvaltar alltså 140 miljarder kronor i genomsnitt, och de säger: jag placerar mina egna pengar i indexfonder, jag skulle inte rekommendera min egen fond till någon annan. På en viss nivå så är det ju helt sjukt.
Varmt välkommen till Rika Tillsammans-podden som handlar om allt som är roligt med privatekonomi och livet. Varje vecka delar vi med oss av vår livsresa, våra erfarenheter, framgångar och misstag så att du ska kunna göra din ekonomi, ditt sparande och ditt liv lite rikare. Vi som driver denna podden heter Caroline och Jan Bolmesson.
Idag är dags för avsnitt 291, och idag så blir det en intervju med två stycken engelska professorer. Och de har intervjuat 69 personer som jobbar inom finansbranschen, jobbar både på liksom sälj- och köpsidan, att de jobbar alltså både som förvaltare, och jag tror att den genomsnittliga förvaltade summan var typ 140 miljarder kronor. Yep. Så att det är liksom inga duvungar. Och sen har de intervjuat analytiker och sånt som jobbar på banker och etc. Och jag vet inte var jag hittade denna studien, men det var liksom så, jag satt en kväll och så läste jag den och så bara så här, vet, slötittade, läste abstract och sen tittade. Och sen så bara så här, shit pommes frites, alltså här är citat liksom från så här: jag skulle inte investerat mina egna pengar i min egen fond, ja. Jag har mina pengar i indexfonder. Och liksom,
och detta kom från aktiva förvaltare.
Ja, precis. Mm. Och de här professorerna tittade liksom på hela den här liksom investeringsvärlden utifrån mer ett människoperspektiv, beteende, social konstruktperspektiv kan man säga. Snarare än liksom så här, perspektivet kring så här, och vilken strategi fungerar bäst. Så att vi intervjuar dem här en timme, och alltså, jag tyckte ju detta var en fantastisk intervju.
Ja, det var det också, för att de använde inte så mycket akademiskt språk ju.
Ja.
De var lätta att lyssna på, tycker jag, och svarade jättebra på frågorna. Ja. Så att man blev lite chockad ibland över liksom vad de hade hört under de här intervjuerna.
Ja. Alltså jag känner så här spontant, nu kanske jag är lite liksom så här entusiastisk för precis avslutat intervjun. Men jag känner att detta är så här, man behöver bara lyssna på tre avsnitt på Riket Tillsammans. Man behöver lyssna på avsnitt 99, hur man investerar enligt forskningen. Och sen behöver man lyssna på detta avsnitt och veta varför man inte ska lägga sina pengar i aktiv förvaltning.
Mm.
Och sen
man får liksom en ytterligare dimension,
ja, precis.
I detta avsnittet.
Och sen kan man lyssna på fyra hinkar-principen. Och sen är du done. Sen behöver du inte lyssna på någonting om investerande eller finans överhuvudtaget.
Mm.
Nej, jag tyckte det var magiskt. Jag ser
vad tog du med dig som stannade kvar hos dig?
Nej, men jag gillade det som de sa, liksom, vad kan man ta med sig här förutom att, alltså, för det är lätt att komma från detta avsnittet och tänka så här, alltså folk i finansbranschen är, som vi pratar, delusional och har liksom kognitiv dissonans.
Men, alltså att de gör saker som egentligen inte stämmer överens med deras egna uppfattningar.
Ja, eller vad det finns, liksom, vad det finns bevis för, ja, vetenskapliga bevis för. Men jag är alltid så här, när jag pekar på någon annan så kommer det liksom tre fingrar som pekar tillbaka till mig själv. Mm. Och då handlar det om så här, så vad kan jag göra annorlunda? Och där handlar det om att inte gå på de här liksom mellanmänskliga, alltså så här, drivkrafterna som vi har, att vi tror på hjältedåd och vi tror på att någon ska lyckas, och vi har en övertro på egen förmåga och alla de här mjuka faktorerna, att det är de som ställer till det.
Ja, och, som man normalt kanske inte ser inom finansbranschen.
Exakt, och där de också säger så här, nej men, du vet, ett förslag är att se på finansmarknaderna utifrån ett socialt perspektiv. Se det som att de som sitter på andra sidan också drivs av vanor, rutiner och relationer.
Har lån att betala. Privatskolor till sina barn och
så
vidare.
Ja, och liksom har så här, nej men den här personen kanske inte är så himla duktig, men han har fru och barn så vi vill inte ge honom sparken utan vi vill ju behålla den här personen. Mm. Alltså allt det här liksom, ja men mellanmänskliga fina kan jag uppleva, men där jag ibland har trillat i fällan och tänkt så här, nej men när jag var i akademin, nej men i näringslivet då handlar det om pengar, då är alla så seriösa och liksom rationella, och sen tänkte man så här, nej men i finansbranschen det handlar om jättemycket pengar, då är de rationella och tar rätt beslut och de bortser från de här mellanmänskliga
känslorna
och det, och så bara nej. Och så på ett sätt och vis tyckte jag att det var ganska fint också.
Yeah.
Men bara för att det är fint så behöver jag inte bidra till att förlora egna pengar.
Nej.
Liksom. Mm. Och rent konkret så pratar vi om allt från ESG, hållbarhet, aktiv, passiv, liksom citat. Vi pratar om liksom skillnaden på professionella investerare, småsparare etc. Så att, jag tyckte detta är ett av mina toppavsnitt alla tider. Mm. Tog du med dig någonting sista innan vi släpper
dem? Det var faktiskt en spännande grej att de forskarna hade då ställt lite frågor till de här aktiva förvaltarna och sen hade de fått svar på helt andra saker. Och då sa de så, då ska man lyssna. Det får ni höra om i avsnittet.
Ja men precis, för deras mål var ju inte att svartmåla finansmål och prata om aktiv passiv, utan de ville egentligen göra en annan studie och sen var det detta som dök upp.
Det var spännande.
Så att, och det är så här, de pratar engelska och den ena pratar till och med lite så här med dialektal engelska. Så att avsnittet här är i sin renaste form på engelska och det finns textat på YouTube och det finns även en transkribering på bloggen. Så för dig som tycker att engelskan är jobbig så det finns andra sätt att ta det till dig. Så att det vill vi verkligen rekommendera. Så ett stort tack och sen tänker jag varsågod. Very welcome, Professor Crawford Spence. You're a professor of accounting and co-director of the Finwork Futures Research Center at King's Business School in London. And among other things, you explore how technical innovation is disrupting financial professions, financial expertise, as well as your research has explored corporate accountability, corporate tax, professional elites, and expertise in financial markets. Welcome, Crawford.
Thank you for having us.
And also a warm welcome to you, Professor Yuval Milo. You are also a professor of accounting at the Warwick Business School. You are a leading contributor to the field of social studies of finance, and your research seeks to understand the social and technological processes that underpin valuation by, among other things, examine social impact, securities, analysts, practices, and algorithmic trading. So welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want to add something to the introduction?
No.
No.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Okay.
It's perfect.
It's cool. So,
very kind.
So before we delve into your study, that's the purpose of this podcast. So our understanding is that the consensus in academia is that a normal retail investor is often better off buying less cheap passive index funds than buying like a few stocks or choosing an active managed fund. And I think you referenced several studies in just the background section of your paper. Would you agree that this is somewhat the consensus in academia? I hope you say yes.
Well, I think it's well established across many different economic studies. But is it a consensus? I'm not entirely sure. I think this is what makes this area so interesting, is that there's very strong evidence to suggest people should not be giving their money to expensive fund managers, but you know they keep doing it anyway. And I think in business schools and other places, we keep teaching them things that you know make students think that this is a great area to go into, and we still create the illusions and fantasies that it's possible to beat the market. So I don't know if it's a consensus, but there's definitely some strong arguments. The support what we are trying to say.
Yeah. There's the whole Just to add and kind of sharpen this, the whole profession or sets of professions that go around fundamental analysis in investing is based on rejecting what you just said, Jan, that you can make money by being smarter than the market. So the consensus is, is hotly debated because a lot of people make a living from rejecting this or aim to make a living from rejecting this. Yeah.
And why do you find that this is such a like big, I wouldn't say a fight, but it's like two very strong different viewpoints. How come? Like we don't have this in physics, for instance, or in other subject areas.
Well, should we go into that? That's our book.
yeah. Please do, like in a short version.
Short version. You're absolutely right, and it's great that you came up with science, because really you have a situation in the knowledge around investment that kind of, in a way, I mean, I'm not comparing now. What I'm going to say now does not compare investment analysis to any of the things that I'm going to say now. You will see in a second. But in a way, it's like Western medicine and and faith healing. Okay, healing, God, and all homeopathy, all kinds of areas like this. So they are really fundamentally disagree on what knowledge is. And on the nature of the phenomena, right? So efficient market hypothesis says that all relevant information is already incorporated in the price, while there are people who basically say, no, we do fundamental analysis, we understand better than the market. So they actually treat, you see what I'm saying? One doctor would say, I'll do some x-rays on your body and understand it. The other one would say, oh, I'm going to call the spirits and the spirits will guide me through. So very different ways of looking at things.
Yeah. And I find this very, very interesting. And we will come into that because that's kind of what you write in your paper as well. Because if I would go to a doctor and the doctor say, well, here is an established, a sciencey way to do things, this heart surgery. But you know what? And this is actually what the fund manager said to me. I want to give myself the opportunity to beat the market. It was like if the doctor said to me, I want to give myself the opportunity to do this in my way, like, I wouldn't kind of accept it. I would like, no, please do the classical heart surgery on me, please. What do you think?
That's interesting, because a lot of people, I think, would say the opposite. You know, particularly when you look at retail investors, they really spend a lot of time not making any money generally, but under this illusion that it's possible to beat the market. And they really think it is possible. And of course, it is to some extent. You look around and there are some people who managed to do it. So you think, well, it must be possible. Maybe I can do it. Or clearly the market is not 100% efficient because it does these wonky things, you know. And maybe you get in there, you do some trades and you make some money over the course of a couple of weeks. And you think, well, I just keep this going if I just work hard enough and absorb enough information. And that's how people get sucked in to this area, particularly in the sort of retail space. So you're very rational, Jan, obviously, right? But not everybody is rational.
Yeah,
certainly not 100% of the time. So
yeah. I would say I'm rational. I'm going to let you in, Kari. I would say I'm rational because I spent 25 years investing as a retail investor, and the first 15 years I just lost money after, or I realized that I didn't beat the index.
Yeah,
Carol, you would.
Yeah, but it's also depends on how you look at it, because there is some conservatism going on everywhere. I read that if you're studying to become a nurse in Sweden, you get all this new science information that you can do this and this, and this is how you treat a wound and so on. And then you go into the hospital to work and they just do it the old ways.
Yeah.
That there's some inertia.
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of behavioral?
Yeah, well, we think it's beyond behavioral. So there's a big area that you're obviously well aware of, Jan. You've talked about this on your podcast before, to do with behavioral finance.
Yeah.
And that is a welcome innovation on traditional finance. It looks at how people sometimes make irrational decisions. They're not perfect at processing information. They have biases. actually, our argument is that it's not just to do with that individual cognition level. It's more of a wider social phenomenon. So the argument that you're making, Caroline, is absolutely appropriate here, and it's a really good parallel, because what we are trying to say with fund management is really a basic sociological argument. It's that fund management is no different from nurses in the healthcare service. You know, we feed people these ideas of dynamism and innovation from economics, but in the real world, it doesn't always work like that. People work on the basis of habit. They work on the basis of routine. They work on the basis of inertia, you know, and just what things, how things have always been done. And financial markets are no different from, you know, nurses. It's no different from real estate. It's no different from lots of other fields in society where things are done on that basis. So it's no surprise that, you know, really some new ideas will come in that show that what people have been doing for a long time doesn't work, but they continue doing it anyway.
Yeah.
I just want to add to that, because financial markets are interesting. Absolutely. As Gordon Ford said, you know, people do that. It's a social activity, institutional activity. Why should it be different from medicine or art or any other thing that people do? But the additional bit here is that we have a theory that, you know, was developed started in the 1950s, that's called Fisher market hypothesis, that basically says, kind of the rationality that Jan was talking about refers to that, right? You cannot beat the market. You might as well put your money in an index. But people resist it all the time. And this kind of goes deeper. People resist it all the time because it takes them out of the picture. There's nowhere where you can be a star, where you can be a hero, where you can tell your stories. Oh, you know, this is what I did, and this is how I beat the market then and there. And it's the same. It's kind of the same logic, societal logic behind lottery. You know that your chance is very low, but you say, why not me? Maybe this week it will be me. I'm going to put my money there. You see what I'm saying? I'm going to get lucky, maybe. So there's some magic, some attractiveness to a story where you do something, where you have agency, and it's not just random movements in the market. And this, I think, what drives fundamental analysis.
Yeah, I think that there's also like a famous study that's repeated every now and then in Sweden about car drivers. And it's, they ask the drivers, are you better or worse than the average driver? In Sweden, we only have 3% of the drivers that are worse than the average driver. And I think it's kind of the same phenomenon.
I think every country does this study, and the percentages are slightly different, but everyone is above average.
And
fund managers as well, you know. I mean, yes, 80% of us don't beat the index, but, you know, I'm one of the 20%. And everyone you speak to says that. And you sort of think, well, where is this other 80% exactly?
Exactly. So like a month ago in early 2023, you published a paper called Active Fund Managers and the Rise of Passive Investing, Epistemic Opportunism in Financial Markets. And you wrote this with your co-author, James Valentine, from Marquette University in Wisconsin. And here is our first question, actually, from the community, from Melva. And she was like, so why did you guys find it important to do this study?
I think because so much money is going into active fund management. And, you know, I mean, you've always been looking at this much longer than me, but I first started looking at this sort of 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I was just astonished to see those figures, whether it's the SPIVA figures or figures from Morningstar or wherever, which just show how many active fund managers underperform the market, don't beat the index. And for me, it just raises a question in my head, which is, well, why does this situation persist? And those people that are in the active space, what do they tell themselves on a daily basis? So I just thought those were interesting questions. That's what motivated me. I don't know if Yuval has the same.
Yeah, I mean, I've been studying financial markets from a qualitative perspective for a while, too long to care to remember. But the sums of money are really impressive, but also what really keeps on tracking me to the markets is the fact that they are part of the kind of, if you like, the cultural bloodstream. Everyone talks about things in terms of return. Everyone uses market language without understanding exactly what are the underpinning forces there, right? People talk about the supply and demand and profitability, even when they speak about something completely different. And I thought, right, this is the leading cultural phenomena of our time. We need to keep on returning to this to understand where it comes from and what it really means. So this is kind of, if you like, the deeper reason. And of course, we're in business school, so it's in, you know, within our remit to study financial markets.
Yeah. And what would you describe, if you each would take, what are the most important findings so far?
So, I mean, we think everything we find is important and talk about it until, you know, tomorrow. But, you know, a few highlights from my side. One is, I think we demonstrate that the lack of faith that active fund managers have in their own domain and their own area of activity. I mean, if we have people turning around to us and saying, you know, I work in active fund management, but I invest all my own money in index funds, or people turn around and saying to us, I wouldn't invest in my own fund, those are fairly startling admissions. And they really display that people don't have faith in what they're doing on a daily basis. And then we ask them, well, why do you do it then? And, you know, they say, well, it's well paid, or, you know, it's interesting, it's stimulating to do this stuff. We may not beat the market, but, you know, yeah, A, I'm getting paid to do it, and B, it's intellectually super, super interesting, you know? And those are all sort of understandable explanations. So, yeah, I mean, I think for me, that's probably the headline thing that jumps out. I don't know if you, Val, you have any other nuances you want to bring out.
This is what came out. I mean, we suspected for a long time, and speaking with Jim, just to mention again, the person who gave us access to a lot of those interesting people that we spoke with and gave us a lot of their time is James Valentine, who's been a sell-side analyst for I think 20 something years, so he really has a lot of contact. Yes, this is what I found interesting as well, but I just want to kind of dig slightly deeper, because it is really interesting. People tell us, you know, I wouldn't invest in my fund because this is really, now I'm paraphrasing, they didn't say directly, they say, oh, this is something for rich people. So it became kind of a, you know, an intellectual pursuit, some kind of a 19th century gentleman's thing. You know, people used to go to the, I don't know, whatever, to the North Pole. Now they do active investment, right? It's kind of a, I wouldn't say an extreme sport, but it stopped being only an economic thing, or less so, because, you know, the FTSE 100 or the S&P 500 will give you better results. You better put the money there. So why do you do it? Crawford said, this is kind of a pastime activity, if you like.
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, because the first thought is that they are delusional, but there's always a method to the madness, I would say. But because when I read your study, I was like, okay, I know this. I've like observed this, this behavioral thing when I met angel investors and a couple of years ago, and I was very like, I wanted to become an angel investor, and I talked to them and I invested my own money, and I just like, for several years, when I went back and looked through the numbers, I realized I lost money, and I went to the other guys and I was like, do you guys make money? And I realized they don't. And I was like, okay, so why are you in this community? But then it was like you said, it was a gentleman's sport. They were on the boards. They got people asking them questions.
They learned stuff. They could give back to the society.
Yeah, but when you ask them why they were doing it, it was for the return. So
it's kind of a, you know, dissonance.
Yeah, and is it that they... Yes, yeah, go. Crawford.
No, the dissonance is a great thing, because actually there's no one simple explanation for it, why anybody does anything. There's always more than one reason. And then there's always the ex post rationalizations as well. So say you undertake something, it doesn't work out. You're always going to find two or three reasons to explain why you actually did it. Oh, it was not about the returns. It was because, you know, I wanted to contribute back to society or whatever. I mean, was that the original motivation? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe this is just a ex post justification for what they've actually done. But we do find a lot of dissonance among the people we spoke to as well. So they both believe and don't believe that it's possible to beat the market. They know that index investing is the way to go, but they still retain some space in their head where they think, they can generate alpha. So they're playing around with these different things at the same time. And I think, you know, the other series of findings that are in the paper talk to how they try and resolve that dissonance. Yeah. So yes, index investing is superior, but it doesn't do price discovery and it doesn't help the market overall. Oh, but who's going to do ESG or save the dolphins or save the planet? Only we can do that, the active fund management community, which is a particularly hilarious claim, really, when you think about it. But we can maybe get into that later. So, you know, there's all these ways they can try and resolve that dissonance. But there is a lot of psychological complexity there, definitely.
Yeah,
that would be fascinating to go into if you want, because
let's go into that.
Just to add to the mix in an earlier study. I mean, I interviewed and followed many hedge fund managers, and many of them express hatred to what they do. They really dislike what they do, and they keep on saying, "Can we use strong language?"
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Many of them told me about a practice that they have that they call fuck you money. Fuck you money is basically the money, you probably heard about it in the investment community, that money that they put aside when kept aside for a situation when somebody would ask them to do something they really don't like and they could say, fuck you, I'm going. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, and this is what talks to the dissonance that Crawford talks to, I spoke with them over time, you know, kind of followed them around for years, and they never use it. You know, the fucking moment never comes. They keep on staying there again and again. Yeah, and I keep on asking, you make more money than you could possibly ever spend. Your grandchildren couldn't spend it. Say, yes, but I'm still not really fulfilled about this. Do you still hate it? Yes. I can't stand it. So you see, it's really weird. It's really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, Crawford, where are you going? Coming in?
No.
Yeah. And how come? What's behind this? What are the psychological drivers that they have this hatred, but they still stay in it? What would you guess?
I could.
Well, so I mean, so people get tied into big mortgages and certain lifestyles, and very few people who are earning the sort of money that is flying around in the fund management area, live a sort of very conservative, you know, modest life. They get sucked into, fine wine, good cheese, and splashing the cash. So it's very hard to walk away from. I mean, think about how many areas, domains in the world pay you so well, even when you underperform. You know, you get your money from fees rather than performance. Generally, it's all about how many assets you have under management rather than how well you manage them. You know, most other domains in society are performance related to some extent. It's a sweet deal for a lot of people. So to expect them to walk away from it is probably unrealistic. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all that everyone keeps their fuck you money and nobody walks away from it.
Mm. Yeah, and you can see that, just about the point, even people who ostensibly don't like a lavish lifestyle gets sucked into that. Because for example, I'll give you an example from I remember vividly a hedge fund manager sitting in they were following potential mergers. So it's a strategy that follows a potential merger, and then they basically gamble on the likelihood of the merger happening. And as part of that, they have a lot of face-to-face meetings with the different sides of the merger. And I was sitting at the back, you know, they were having the meeting and I was just taking notes and listening. And then the other guys left the room, and they were from a potential buyer. And I told, I asked the hedge fund manager, so what do you think about them? And they said, I cannot respect them. I said, why? I mean, they make perfect sense. He said, did you look at their watches? They were wearing some cheap plasticky things. These are not people we can really. So, you know, they had enough money to buy Rolexes, but they wouldn't. For some reason, they were not respected. So you see, it becomes a signal of seriousness that you can actually spend some money.
Yeah.
So just one example. There were many.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. But because it's easy to like point the finger at the fund industry and kind of laugh at them that they're kind of cognitive dissonance and they're delusional. But I would say, what are we doing that are pointing at them? Because if you point at somebody, you have three fingers pointing back at yourself. What's our role? Are the community's role or the pension funds or the other, we with the money?
But this really needs to be our next study, which is why so many pension funds and individuals keep giving the money to mutual funds. You know, why does Vanguard not have more money under management, really? And, you know, we can only speculate on that just now. I mean, some things we do know straight off the bat is that, particularly in Europe, there are still a lot of incentives for individual investment advisors to direct their clients' money towards mutual funds and active funds in general. That's not quite the same in the US. So the shift towards passive in the US, I think, has been much more aggressive because the way in which investment advisors are incentivized is a bit different. Also, there are more. It's more tax efficient, I think, the way in which the tax system is set up in the US to invest in things like ETFs. So that the sort of institutional context surrounding this needs to change a little bit to make it more to change the economic incentives for people to move towards it. Because there are still some barriers in place, but you know, beyond those barriers, there are always going to be people who entertain these illusions that they can beat the market, or that someone that they appoint can beat the market on their behalf. So I don't see how that will change. You know, I mean, we do anticipate more flows towards passive funds in the foreseeable future, but you know, there's always going to be some core of active funds out there selling the snake oil.
And that kind of links also to what we said before about the kind of the myth of the hero. That's one. And secondly, this is an interesting point that nobody speaks about that much. Nobody speaks that much about is that the active trading introduces some new ideas into the market. I mean, they are right about it. Mostly those ideas are not very good, but replicating existing portfolios, so in tracking funds and all that, does not really add any intentional movement to the market, right? You just keep on buying. But the mistakes that are, you know, brave mistakes, let's call it, that active fund managers make cannot introduce movement to the market. You see what I'm saying? They present it as a positive thing. Look, we provide for price discovery. No, not really. You provide noise, but noise is interesting because it attracts other people to enter the market and so on. So if everything is replicative, then you're gonna have some weird movements that don't follow anything, right? Mm. If this makes sense, I can go into the technology.
Yeah, like if you go, because that's the most common argument against the passive investing. It was like, I think, by Michael Burry, that if everybody would invest in index funds, you wouldn't have any price discovery. Every IPO would get valued as Apple, and you had this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think, you know, that's probably true, but, you know, it's also a false sort of case that's been presented, because we're never going to have a situation where we have 100% index, you know? I mean, no government is going to regulate active investing completely out of the market. And some of the arguments around price discovery have merit to them. I suppose the issue is, do we need to be paying, you know, 2% and then 20% out for, you know, to for outperformance to people in order to provide that function? And do we need to have 50% of assets under management managed by active people in order to achieve those things? Or could those figures be radically different? You know, do we only need, you know, 20% of the market to be actively managed in order to achieve that? Or do we need, you know, and certainly fees need to be compressed a lot more as well. So, you know, I think, you know, there's merit in those arguments, but, you know, it's the whole idea of 100% passively managed economy, it doesn't really make that much sense.
I agree. And that also the political argument about the level of fees, of course, is the debate should be out there. But if we could talk about quality of price discovery, it has gone down a lot, because events that have got nothing to do with the let's call it the fundamental value, if we believe in that, of companies, move markets much more than such events. So changing the composition of the S&P 500 is going to move the markets much more than, let's say, some interesting news about Tesla. Mm. Because just because of the sizes involved, right? Mm. So I in this particular element, I really support the kind of the knowledge stand of the active community. Mm. Right? They react to economic events rather than to some institutional movements. Yeah.
Yeah. Professor Spence, you were saying it was like there's a claim in the active community that, okay, we do the ESG, who's going to save the dolphins? And you said that it's actually a hilarious claim. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, where is the track record of you know, sort of the of financial markets in making the world a better place? I mean, all the stuff we're talking about is actually, from a social point of view, deeply problematic. I mean, finance effectively operates as a tax on society. Yeah. And, you know, it takes money out of the markets. It takes liquidity out of the markets. I mean, if 80% of trades that take place, they are high frequency trades. You know, this is pure speculation. All that serves is to leech money out of the market, out of people's retirement and savings accounts, and into, you know, the world of high frequency, the pockets of high frequency traders. And, you know, your paper is not really about HFT. It's about mutual fund managers and hedge fund managers. But, you know, the same goes there as well. You know, they're there just, you know, basically capturing rents from other people in the form of fees rather than performance. So that's a real problem. And, you know, one of the justifications for doing that, our research shows, is that, well, you know, if it wasn't for us, nobody would be putting pressure on companies to improve their corporate governance or to improve their ESG. Of course, this used to be called CSR or sustainability or other things, but now they've changed the acronym and apparently we should all take it more seriously. And I just think there's very little for us to take heart from. Yeah, I think the track record of the fund management community and putting pressure upon companies is really very limited. And actually big index providers have big engagement teams now as well. Yeah. So the evidence doesn't show that the active fund management community are any better than passive investing vehicles in this regard. And actually this is just not the role of financial markets. You know, if we're placing all our hopes and dreams in fund managers to save the planet, then, you know, we're going to end up in a Mad Max scenario much quicker than we previously thought. You know, this is a role of policymakers. If you want companies to behave better, you're not going to, you know, get people who are incentivized, you know, to maximize returns to go out there and force companies to behave better. You know, you need to change policy. You need to change regulation. You need to change laws.
Mm. Just about the ESG, kind of, if we want to be cynical about this and realistic, okay, let's put it this way. The claim that an active fund manager would change the minds of, I don't know, whatever, Shell or BP to become greener is a bit, you know, I wouldn't say delusional, but a bit optimistic. Because what is the size of your holdings and how long you're going to hold them for? Right. Mm-hmm. So they know whatever strategy you have, you're going to hold over tens of millions and you're going to hold them for about a month and then you're going to sell it. Right. Relatedly. But if you're a tracker, if you're your BlackRock or Vanguard, you're holding them for a long time and you have a big holding. So if they come to you, right, somebody like BlackRock and says, right, we don't like what you're doing in the Arctic, they're going to listen more. I'm not saying I agree with Crawford that they're like, you know, relying on these people to save the planet is, you know, is a fever dream. But really the big trackers, just because they are the big you know, behemoth of the market, can actually change the minds of big companies. Because if they pull out from a company, if, for example, it will make headlines everywhere if somebody like BlackRock or Citadel with the trackers would go to oil companies and said, you know, we can take the heat of not holding you because we don't like what you're doing. Mm-hmm. At the very least, I would see them, you know, putting out some frenzied PR. Mm.
Yes.
Right. But yeah, some hedge fund do that. Yeah. They will say, okay, bye bye.
But it's also important to recognize that this is sort of culturally specific. So we spoke to half of our interviewees were from the UK, half of them are from the US. Yeah. And nobody in the US was talking to us about ESG. Right. It was all these arguments were coming out of the UK. And, you know, it's more of a European phenomenon, this. And actually, just now, there's a big backlash against ESG in the US. There's some controversy around there. So, you know, from a sort of liberal progressive point of view, you think, oh, well, you know, Europe's more advanced here. You know, you've got those Neanderthal Americans that don't care about the planet. And, you know, and I'm sympathetic to that view on one level. But actually, when you analyze it, you know, what we have coming out of Europe in terms of discourse in ESG is very disingenuous and possibly diverts attention from real change. So if people think that the fund management industry have got this under control, you know, they're not going to be out in the streets protesting or asking for our governments to actually do something about, you know, reducing CO2 emissions. That's not necessarily happening so much in the US either. But I think there's probably more honesty among the US fund management community because they don't claim to be doing this stuff. They don't claim that's part of their remit. And I don't believe it's really part of the remit of European fund managers either. I think it's just a discourse that they've advanced to justify their position. It's a Hail Mary in against the backdrop of underperformance, really.
Yeah, exactly. That's the view in Sweden as well. This is a way to market the funds when you can't market them on performance.
Exactly.
When I read your paper, you said that you had to coin a new term to capture what was going on with this dissonance and this delusion almost, and you called it epistemic opportunism. How would you explain this term? You even have it in the title of your paper.
Yeah. So we played around with these ideas for a while. And first of all, you know, our original idea was epistemic stasis, you know, because they come up with the same ideas to new problems. This new threat of passive investing is growing. How are we going to respond to it? Oh, just by doing the same stuff we've always done and coming up with the same arguments we've always come up with. And to some extent, that is true. But, you know, we thought about this and reflected on this and we realized there was something more dynamic happening here. You know, and so an attempt to try and resolve that dissonance we were talking about earlier is to advance this kind of opportunistic discourse, which is kind of like a scattergun approach. You know, we just see what's going to stick, or we throw a few arguments out there and see what's going to hit something. And, you know, one of them is the ESG, you know, which is very opportunistic, self-serving discourse. The other one is price discovery, which, you know, there's some merit in that, but as we've discussed, I think we can debunk that to a significant extent. And then the other one we've not talked about is, you know, well, bring on the bear market. You know, yeah, fine, passive has eaten us alive because there's been a bull market for the last 10 years. But, you know, when things start going south, you'll see that we need the hedge funds. Well, you know, things have been going south for the last year. And the data now shows pretty clearly the active fund management community, whether it's mutuals or hedge funds, are really still being outperformed by index investing. So, you know, these different arguments, you know, they're all, you know, highly debatable. You know, we think they can be debunked pretty convincingly, but they're advanced all the time in a very opportunistic fashion. So it's opportunistic and it's a self-serving discourse. And, you know, the epistemic thing is that it's saying, you know, our knowledge base is still as relevant as it ever was, really.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But the short answer to your question, Jan, is why did you come up with this phrase? Is because we need to come up with new ideas as academics.
Right? This is what we sell.
Exactly. Yeah. This is our snake oil.
Just to frame this is not what we do exactly in our research, and there are others who do historical studies, but kind of, again, having been in this area of research for quite a while, I think in the last I would say maybe 15 years, the active has been really given a challenge, because passive has existed for a long, long time, but there's a kind of nice constellation of factors that really put them on the spot. You know, the frequent crashes and the rise of the, if you like, the cultural acceptedness of automation and all kinds of other things that are really interesting layered together. And now they are left with, you know, kind of their, if you like, epistemic habitat is dying out. There are less and less excuses that they could sell to show that they are superior. So I don't know what will happen. Of course, nobody has a crystal ball, but it looks like they will now need to come up with something new.
Wow.
Did you feel like that they were relieved or happy that you were asking them? They were relieved to talk about this?
I think, anyway, you probably see this from your podcast perspective. Whenever you sit and interview someone for an hour, they love to talk, right? They really like to discuss their world. And I think people don't sit them down for an hour or an hour and a half and ask them about what they're doing, why they're doing it. Mm. Most of them are just out there trying to you know, invest in funds or do analysis or whatever. So I think a lot of people found it quite interesting. And I know the outcome of the paper is, you know, is quite critical of this community. But, you know, we come away from every meeting having a really stimulating conversation with people. Generally they seemed really nice, with a couple of exceptions. Of the sort of 70 people we interviewed, you know, almost to a person, they were very pleasant, super bright, generally, you know, very stimulating. And, you know, some of them more reflective than we thought. We didn't anticipate people telling us so much about, you know, how much they thought index funds were superior to the sort of stuff they were doing on a daily basis. What that conversation did for them ultimately, I mean, an hour after they spoke to us, they were back there trying to beat the market, right? So probably not that much overall. But, you know, we gave them a free therapy session.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But it kind of, to come clean, we didn't go out there specifically to ask about active passive. It came from them.
That's right.
It came, you know, this was something that was on their mind, and they kept on justifying kind of their existence in that world. So in a way, it kind of
ranges. As a researcher, sorry, Yuval, but as a researcher, when someone starts answering questions that you've not even asked them, you need to start paying attention to that, right?
Yeah, you know,
there's always something there. What is that telling us? So we pivoted our study in a way to focus on this in much more detail.
So
I suppose to answer your question, Caroline, if this came from them rather than us, you know, there's a catharsis there, I suppose, or some need to let this out. I mean, I'm not a psychoanalyst. I can't fully explain that. But on a psychodynamic perspective, I think there's something interesting going on there.
Yeah.
What were the personal highlights from the interviews? What has stuck with you? Because you interviewed like 69 people for more than an hour, so it's a lot of material. So what are like the golden nuggets for you guys?
In what area?
Yeah, like so what? Yeah. But take it away.
Well, there's some things we couldn't really put in the paper. People telling us that they basically, you know, breached regulations, and you know, sell side analysts, for example, are supposed to say, "Oh, buy, sell, or hold for stocks." More than one person told us, "Oh, we have a policy where we just don't rate anything as a sell," which is in the US is a breach of regulation FD, and you know, you could potentially be struck off a list or something. For disclosing that sort of information. So that's interesting. We weren't surprised that that happens. We were surprised that people admitted to that happening.
Yeah, it's like an open secret.
Exactly. But it's great to have someone confirm it, right? And it's only like two or three people out of 69 that say that. But if two or three people out of 69 are telling you that, you know it's happening pretty much, you know, across the board. And actually, you just need to look at Bloomberg and see the number of sales that analysts put on there. And it's basically zero, right? So we know that there are massive conflicts of interest in this community. So, you know, we got little nuggets about that sort of those sort of conflicts of interest and some of the sort of dirty work that goes on behind the scenes with financial intermediaries, which I thought was quite interesting. But I suppose the headline stuff, just to repeat, was that lack of faith in what they do.
For me, it was kind of it kind of, it was this element, but that's kind of more forensic, and a lot of people would tend to, you know, assume or suspect this goes in the background. Something that was more kind of sinister and for me was the self-censorship. So when people compare themselves all the time to the consensus numbers, and they don't even dare present numbers that go against the consensus, because even though their models and their rationale tells them, look, really, we differ from what everyone else is saying, and also that's supposed to be highly sought after, right? This is how you become famous. They dare not do it. They keep on checking and checking again their models, trying to find out where they went wrong, assuming that they went wrong. So yeah. For me, that was a big aha moment.
Yeah. So they've got this, you know, this mantra to beat the market, but then they've all these social pressures and personal anxieties about following the herd, so that they don't look daft.
Yeah.
When if they're out of line, when something goes wrong, they get a call wrong. So that's a kind of dichotomous environment that they operate in. And also, a lot of people hire people they like a lot in this space. People that are like them, that have a similar cultural background. We know this from many other fields, which sort of explains part of the underperformance as well. You know, they're not hiring people all the time on the basis of merit or what they can do. They're hiring them on the basis of, you know, what they look like, what they sound like, and just because they've always been there. And, you know, we had people tell us, well, listen, you know, I know this guy's useless, but we're still going to pay him 300 grand a year because, you know, he's got a wife and kids in school. And, you know, it wouldn't be nice of us to cut them down to zero.
Yeah.
And this, that makes me think, as someone who, you know, has a pension, well, that's great, isn't it? All my pension flows are going towards these people that don't do very much.
Yeah.
And this kind of, just the last point, we can see that the buy side and the sell side, you know, we think of them as economic functions, but they're not just that. It's a social network that grows through the biographies of people. You know, you start as a very junior sell side and you find connections with certain buy side jobs that you like, and they move up, you move up with them, and so on. Then 25 years later, when basically, you know, passive does so much better than what you can think of, you still maintain your little ecosystem. Why? Because they are your friends as well. You go with them to football matches. You share information. You know their kids. They know yours, and so on. You see? These are the kind of the living, breathing roots of inertia,
yes,
and conservatism and herding.
Yeah, You know, actually, what when I hear you guys talking about it, I think that it's there are a lot of human. I haven't seen this human side of it with all its flaws. It's about the relationships. It's about the human flaws that we like Daniel Kahneman wrote about in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. So they're humans. They do all the human specific,
which we tend to overlook when we just want to look at one thing, and then this is the you know, the breed. No, the basis.
Yeah.
Complex question.
That I think that we think of the finance industry. They are well paid. They're managing this. They're professional. They manage a lot of money. They are not suspect to all these stupid things that I do on my spare time.
No, you're right. And you know what? Actually, a lot of the stuff we find here is just very unsurprising. Whenever we present this to academics, everyone says, this is just like academia. Right, we could present the paper to a bunch of people in the hotel industry, and they'll say, "Oh, this is like hoteliers," you know. I mean, we talked about nurseries before. I mean, all these dynamics exist in every field. The thing is, why do we not expect them to exist also in financial markets?
Yeah.
Because our thinking of financial markets is dominated by economists, right? And economists know nothing about human behavior. Right, they're very good at econometrics. They're very good at different, you know, running different software programs. They like to think they can pronounce on how humans behave, but they are probably the least qualified people on the planet to make these pronouncements. So actually, you know, you go in there with ask them very basic sociological questions, and you find out, oh, humans don't behave like rational economic man after all. Surprise, surprise. So in some ways, you know, we're a bit bored by these findings because they're so obvious. But we need to make those arguments, because the dominant thesis within financial markets is all driven by economics, which is a problem.
Hmm. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And in the paper I just sent you, I don't know if you want to cut this out, but in the paper I just sent you at the beginning, you'll find, you know, song and verse about all this.
Can't you tell us about it? Because you said that this paper is actually a part of a, we call it Tower paper, I think. No, we skipped that. But you called it, this was like a piece of a larger study. Can't you tell us, like, if we zoom out, so what's the larger study and what's the purpose of it?
Yes, we've got these two papers, the one that we've talked about today, this them just published, and another one that's, you know, hopefully going to be published very soon. And we're coalescing these into a book, which is going to be published by Columbia University Press next year. And, you know, it's all based on the same data. It's based on the same interviews with the same people with just slightly different arguments. So the other paper, which, you know, Yuval has just sent you, is really talking about the social environment within which the active fund management community operates and the social dynamics that drive their behavior. So some of that stuff we're talking about, hiring your friends, you know, you have these biographical ties, you grow up with people in the industry, so you keep hiring people that you know rather than people who might perform better. And you're all this hugging consensus rather than trying to provide a distinctive opinion. All these are all sort of social norms and institutional factors that point towards conservatism in this area and stop people in this space being more dynamic. So there's inertia, there's stasis, there's routine, there's habit. And it all points towards really how financial markets need to be understood within a social context. All economic activity takes place within a social context. So you have all that human and cultural stuff that comes in and stops people acting as the economic theorists tell us they're supposed to act.
And
they act in different ways.
And what we offer more specifically here, just kind of, again, this is old news in sociology, but we employ the concept of field, which comes direct originally from the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, and looking at people acting within and around financial markets as a field that produces, you know, political discourse, maintains relationships, opens up, kind of it like really removes the blinders from our eyes, because instead of just looking for where is the utility maximizing element here, you're saying no, it's not utility maximizing. They follow routines. They understand the world through practicing routines and some tacit understandings of things like we do in society. Why should we look at the profession, the set of routines that happen in financial markets any differently? Then you start looking at markets very differently, right? You see what I'm saying? It's not just the information that is important. It's also prestige. It is also social ties and so on. Now, of course, we're not, you know, kind of reinventing the wheel here. People have done it many times in different areas, but very little in financial markets, especially on the very kind of open to the public side of sell side analysts.
Yeah, and I would say that the self-view in the finance industry is also would say that we are above that in some kind, because we glorify, we have these billions, you know, these series, and you have the star fund manager who has overperformed, and you have the star research analyst.
So, they're even part of the movement and development of humankind forward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think we get sidetracked when it's money involved, and we glorify it rather than.
Yeah, or we focus on the sort of limited number of people who do seem to have beat the market over a long period of time. It's very small numbers, and the longer the time goes on, the numbers get even smaller. And we use them and we extrapolate their experience to the rest of the fund management community, but it's not representative at all. And even those guys who do manage to beat the market, we don't know if it's because they're skillful or because they're lucky. I mean, you know, they're great for 10, 15 years, and then we realize they've taken some massive risks, they've paid off, and then it all goes south for them at one point. Very few people have full careers in this space.
Just adding to that, and this is again kind of borders on the forensic, but it really is important. When you become a star analyst, right? In the last few weeks, I've been listening to conference calls. You know, when they speak with the managers. When you become a star analyst, it is also in the interest of the CFO, CEO to give you prominence, okay? Because they know that people listen to you, right? So it becomes a bit of a symbiotic relationship, right? They would be happy to give you maybe, don't want to say inside information or anything like this, but kind of open up the doors and show
you. They answer when you call.
Yeah, exactly. In return, you are, using your reputation to say smart things about them that are not too critical, right? That's the price you pay. So you see, it's easier for you not to go very wrong with the company, unless the whole thing goes south, obviously. So as you move up, it's harder for you to.
Sorry, yeah, but this leads to all sorts of other problems and delusions as well. So, you know, you've curried favor with company management. The answer when you call, as you say, Jan. So then what happens then is you think you've got superior access to information, right? So, but we ask them, so what do you get with a special relationship with the CFO? And they say, oh, we get no new information, but when I'm speaking to him, I know from his body language, from his facial expressions, whether he's telling the truth or not. And we hear this time and time again from people. And I don't know about you, Yuval, but I think we've talked about this. So I think you're probably the same view as me. We sit there and we think, really, this is what you've got? This is your USP? You know, you can, you know, interpret somebody raising their eyebrow as an indication of whether or not they're going to beat the next quarterly earnings target. And, you know, but that's it. We're back to, you know, the quack doctor selling the snake oil and the magic in the air. And this is what we're paying the high fees for, that sort of stuff.
And
it really is currency, because even putting aside kind of, I remember in one of the interviews, I think it was, they told us, yeah, we had some lectures by FBI people, and they told us to they gave us some toolkit to see how, when people lie and all that. So it goes into really ridiculous length, but it's also currency, because a lot of those analysts would love to tell you that they met the CEO face to face. In our last meeting with the CEO, we heard this, and as we walked to the coffee table, these are actual quotes from analyst reports. So they would love to give you some stardust. Look, we actually spoke with Tim Cook. We actually saw him preparing his coffee.
And then, in turn, to go back to one of your earlier questions, you know, why are we still giving our money to fund managers? Well, if you're sitting in a pension fund, you're under pressure to perform. You're going to give your money maybe to somebody who has that superior access. You can turn around and say, oh, you know, I've met Tim Cook, right? So then you're a pension fund trustee, you can turn around to the people whose money you're managing and say, you know, we do our due diligence, we hire the brightest and best and make sure that they're managing your money. So, you know, that's slightly speculation because we've not actually done those interviews, but I suspect there's a lot going on along that vein.
In the pension fund side that I know from a different area, and I'm sure it happens. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in other funds as well. Kind of, it's a way to keep your job, right? You don't get fired by being wrong with everyone else, right? No. So you went with a reputable fund manager. Of course, they didn't do very well because the market, you know, was moving up and down as it does. But hey, you know, I went I'm not going to say names, but okay, with X. Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah,
don't worry.
It's like when I call it in management, like, oh, we used McKinsey, so it's not our fault. Not even McKinsey could save us.
Exactly. McKinsey effect.
Yeah, exactly. Just a few questions before we round down. You also wrote about, three defensive mechanisms, that it was like strong identity and like, I think you wrote like one reaction entails asserting a strong identity which can rally previously disparate members of community together and offer a renewed sense of purpose. Would you like to say something more about that?
So this is really the attachment to what Yuval was talking about earlier, which is fundamental analysis. So we were in there, you know, a big part of index investing is about leveraging technology at scale. It's really been made possible through technology. And, you know, we're going through some sort of technological revolution or significant evolution, at least just now with big data and AI and things like that. So we were asking people about how is this disrupting your field? How are you taking on, you know, how are you responding to the movements in big data? Are you changing your analysis techniques, blah, blah, blah? Is that a way for you to compete with passive or index investing? And by and large, they said, well, no. What we do is fundamental analysis, which is really a world of small data. And we're looking for little nuggets of information, individual pieces that nobody else has. Yeah. Mm. So I'm a transport fund manager. I specialize in the transportation sector. You know, I'll fly out to off the coast of Louisiana, spend some time with people who work on barges, speak to them about what's happening with the shipping channels and the cargo that's coming in and out. And maybe I'll find something interesting about, you know, whether Amazon is selling toilet paper to people in Hawaii. So, you know, so the supermarkets are not going to do so well, or the ships, you know, so we're talking about little things here. And he's like, I can do this. Supercomputers cannot do this, but I can go there and do that heavy lifting and find that nugget of information, which my clients or the funds I work for are going to be able to act upon as actionable investment advice. So, you know, we had, you know, numerous examples of this nature. They sound really humorous, but they were all very idiosyncratic.
But you know what? It sounds attractive. Like when you're telling the story, I'm like, yeah, yeah.
We've heard it.
Yeah, because we've interviewed fund managers and they say exactly, like we don't go to expos with other fund managers. We go to this expo with this niche and we meet customers and suppliers and we talk to them. We don't talk to the finance industry. We do our own picture, and we have even stayed in the jungles of Brazil and fought with tigers. And you know, you're wow, yeah, like so you get
attractive arguments.
They are, and they're evocative, right? And there's strong imagery there. So you think, yeah, you're right, a supercomputer cannot do that. And you go away thinking, well, okay, he's working hard, certainly working hard, and he's doing something unique. Nobody else is flying down to look at toilet paper movements, you know, to Hawaii on barges off the coast of Louisiana. But zoom out, right? I mean, where's the performance over a sort of 5 to 10 year period? And, you know, the data shows that it's just not there. So this stuff is obviously not that important. Nevertheless, they're very wedded to this. This is part of their identity. We live in a world of nuggets of information and small data and unique insights.
Yeah, and we love a good story. Yes. As humans.
it rolls back to the cultural image that we discussed before, you know, the narrative of you're the hero, you're moving history. You find the people behind the people, who will give you the real cause of things.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you said another one was you wrote a defensive maneuver is to delegitimize non-members' knowledge and establish boundaries between us and them.
Yeah.
And I think you even had some interviewees saying that there's a lot of
incompetent
people in the industry.
Yeah. So they do two things here. They throw mud at two sets of people. They throw mud at the passive people and say, well, you're just like dumb money, throwing money or whatever's in the index, that's leading to price momentum and wonky price movements. We are the clever, savvy ones who can engage in price discovery and effectively make markets efficient. That's their argument, yeah. And they even say, we're a public good. Someone told us we're a public good for doing this, you know. And the second group of people they throw money at is basically themselves or their colleagues. And this is going back to the Swedish average car driver phenomenon, you know. So, you know, most people in this area are really, you know, incompetent, below average, but actually I'm not one of them. But then, you know, everybody is saying that. So somebody is going to be below average, statistically speaking.
And they also, this is a kind of a nice hybrid argument. They say that the fact that we have lower and lower quality of analysis is because of passive. Because there's passive, more money goes to passive, less money is going to active. Therefore, we have, you know, we can recruit lower caliber of people, and we overburden them with work because they need to cover more stocks.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
They have no less time to come up, you know, with really important nuggets of information. They cannot go to the, you know, to the jungles of Borneo to find where whatever the beginning of the supply chain, because we cannot fund them. So it's all kind of it's all the way around. It's passive's fault. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And then the final one was, you said also that communities can also defend their existing field position by making a practice inaccessible to others, perhaps by inscribing their worldviews into particular artifacts or practices.
So this is flowery academic language. You know, we have to speak in these ways to get published in academic journals. But basically, this is saying that passive cannot do ESG. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a practice area that passive is incapable of doing. Only we can do that. And of course, we've talked about how plausible this argument is already. But that's a standard thing that communities will do to justify themselves. So that's it. Yeah. I mean, that's the epistemic opportunism right there.
Yeah. Did you get a feel how common it was that they didn't invest in their own funds, or that they had a majority in index, or?
So this is a minority of people that are being open in this extent, and we're not asking everybody, do you invest in
and I know in the US there are numbers, you have to report it to the SEC, but there were some like limits there. So
okay,
yeah.
Right. But you know, so we never. But again, this is something that they offered up voluntarily. Yeah. So I mean, like, you know, I'd say, you know, sort of 10% of people we spoke to were quite relatively open about this. Which doesn't sound like much, but actually, given that we're not even asking them that question, that's quite a lot. And if one person is saying that, that's already a lot.
Yeah. Like, we know this from experience in Sweden as well. When we had the first fund robot, like Betterment, started in Sweden, the founder said that the first money they received was from fund managers. Like,
but maybe they wanted to test it.
They were first of all. Here we got the question from our community head. GBL has like, so what would you say if your kids or a dear friend came and told you that they're becoming active fund managers?
Well, I mean, it could still be a good career option. You know, I mean, hope springs eternal. I mean, I don't think it's a meaningful activity to engage in. The sad thing is, you know, everyone we speak to in this field is just super bright, well-educated, capable of doing so much stuff. And I always come away thinking, you know, you should be building bridges or doing heart surgery. But, you know, the economic incentives for them to do what they're doing are much higher than those other fields of activity. So it's completely plausible that they remain there. You know, would I be happy if my kids went in that space? Sometimes I come away from these interviews thinking, I wish I was doing what they were doing. They get paid 12 times as much as I do. Actually, I do think they can sleep at night. I mean, we got into academia because we thought this was meaningful socially, you know, but we all have mortgage stresses and worries and, you know, have to go on strike to try and get decent pay deals. You don't see any of that in hedge funds. So I suppose there's a little bit of schadenfreude recognizing that, you know, their activity is getting eaten up by index funds all the time. But at the same time, you know, it is interesting work. It's exciting, you know, it's well remunerated. And there's always good for the foreseeable future. There's still going to be a sizable amount of people in that space, definitely. So yeah, that's my honest answer, really.
Yeah, and it's kind of a sub question to the bigger question of automation. You know, quite a lot of probably saw, you know, what is it called, ChatGPT and all that recently, that everyone is saying, oh, you know, who's going to write the reports? Yeah, I don't know, but kind of just echoing what Crawford said, and I think there's something deeper within us that want people to do meaningful things, right? You know, the homo faber and all that. And I think active fund management is just another expression of that. Of course, there is the economic side, but like, it's a way to express your agency.
Mm. We are talking a lot in our podcasts about that you want to have the majority of your money in index, and then you can have some on the side. Learning money or playing in the
to get set to satisfy your other needs.
Yeah,
I think that that a good strategy for most people would be like separate the financial side. Okay, this I need to be able to retire, and this I have to have fun, to have my war stories, to be able to tell
to
how
learn.
I lost a lot of money. You know, this stock went down 90%, and this was a 10 bagger. And we need that. We need those stories as humans, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Well, maybe if you have spare money, then you have money to burn, then I guess that's fine. But, you know, Jack Bogle would always just stick it all in index funds, right? I mean, Warren Buffett, the most famous investor on the planet, is, you know, leaving in his will that all his money has to go 90% into an index fund. And I think the other 10% is in US treasuries.
Yeah,
oh, cash. Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I mean, you know, he doesn't believe in active fund management either. Yeah. So I think people are a bit different, you know. Maybe some people want that little bit of what Eric Balchunas would call hot sauce, you know, go with the ETFs and index for 60 or 80% and leave some space for hot sauce on the side.
As you said, but just this, the thought that, you know, the financial markets, supposedly the, you know, the temple of rationality are there basically to satisfy some emotional needs. Is a bit of a heresy if you think to our colleagues in the economics department.
Yeah, definitely. Like two last questions. Is there any other question that we should have asked that we missed?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you covered a lot of it, and we went into some detail as well, which is good. And we even managed to expand beyond and look at the wider project, which is really about the social structures that support this. And I think, you know, one of the key headline arguments we're just trying to take away is that using economics to understand economic phenomena is going to take you to a very strange place intellectually. Yeah. You really need to take social theory and social science to understand financial markets.
Yeah. I would say, I don't think you missed any questions, but kind of, I want to tie two strands here that you seem to have. I think that if people who listen to this podcast want to get some advice about their, you know, their investment, like they are day traders or something, I would say that they would do better if they understood the social structure of the market and those motivations that we speak about, right? They would potentially do better, you know, financially. So this is, I think you've done it really, you know. I saw the two strands there, but kind of these are also, it's part of the toolkit that a good investor may have.
Yeah, look at it from that perspective. I think you have somewhere in the paper, I noticed it when I read it last night, that you should say that financial markets should be seen from a social context.
But that can be one of the impacts from your article, actually. Do you have other hopes for impact from this study?
I mean, you know, these sorts of things are generally directed at other academics. So that's great. We're now getting a wider audience with, like, you know, this podcast and some other things as well. It would be interesting to see how it lands with the actual fund management community itself.
Yeah.
So it would, you know, be nice to go to some of their conferences and present some of this information.
Yeah.
I mean, I have done some of that before with some previous research, and, you know, they're kind of unsurprised because obviously you're presenting their ideas, their discourse back to them. So they're like, yeah, that's what happened. But I think they know what's happening better than anyone else does. I think the issue is we in academia and in the media and other places go away and represent what happens in financial markets in a distorted way. Because we expect it to happen according to certain, you know, economic theories or things like that, or certain common sense understandings, whereas actually this sort of analysis exposes that, you know, it's a viper's nest of conflicts of interest and dodgy incentives and, you know, old habits and routines. But the fund management industry itself is well aware of that. It's everyone else that needs to be aware of it that then puts pressure on it to reform it effectively.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's like also one of my insights. It's like we can finger point at the industry, but still it's that we are giving them our money. So we are kind of...
We are
enablers. Cool. We have two questions that we always ask all our guests. And the first one is, now maybe it's redundant when we've talking about this, but what's the worst financial advice that you've heard? Or the worst advice in the financial industry
in our studies?
It's in general. Like we even had one guest say like monthly savings. So you can say anything.
Right. So the worst thing I heard, and I've seen this not from my personal experience, but someone quite close to me, thought that they could take their old pension pot into their own hands and do much better than they were actually doing. I mean, the pension was probably being managed by an actively managed fund manager, right? But it was sort of doing okay. They took it into their own hands and, you know, threw a lot of it into basically three or four different companies, high risk ventures in the developing world. And, you know, they basically lost about 90% of it. You know, we have some very negative things to say about the active fund management industry, but it could be even worse if you take it out of institutional structures and try and do it yourself.
My example was very similar. Again, someone I know fairly well and asked me a few years ago, "What do you think I should be doing?" And I said to him, you know, we had a long discussion along the lines of what we had here. We said we can make fun of the active fund managers, but they really put in a lot of thought behind that. And he said, "Well, surely I can do better." And you know, we're at that end, not with pension money, but the, you know, a lot. I would say the worst advice could be something along the lines of, "Yeah, do some day trading. What's the worst that can happen?"
everything.
That would be a very bad advice. I mean, play with fake money for a long time and see how deep the rabbit hole is.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm just going to shoot in one question, because now we've talked about the fund industry, but now when we talk about it, like if you go to the retail investors, would you say it's like transferable, or is it even worse in the retail space? Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I mean, the data shows that in the retail space, virtually nobody beats the market. In the active fund, in the institutional space, some people do. It just, you know, not very many over time. And the potential for losses is probably even greater in the retail market as well. I mean, you know, the people we speak to in the institutional space are super bright, super clever, and fine, they're not beating their benchmarks, but they're not far off it, right? I mean, mostly they're not beating their benchmarks because they charge fees that are too high rather than, you know, they're not making reasonable decisions. That's not the case in the retail space. You know, the retail space, you have all sorts of crazy behavior going on. So if these, you know, super bright guys that we are speaking to in the institutional space can't beat the market, then, you know, nobody else can, really. And I think that's the key. That's the key takeaway.
I agree.
And that's my view as well. Because even if in the fund industry you have like this compliance, you have the risk management, you have the UCITS rules, etc. So, which you don't have on the retail side, so you can screw up faster. Last question: do you have a book that you recommend? And it can be—it doesn't have to be about finance. It can be a non-fiction book or a fiction book.
The Vanguard book was good that you sent to me, Crawford.
What one's that?
The Bogle one.
Oh, Eric Balchunas, sort of Bloomberg ETF guy, has just written a book called The Bogle Effect, which is about Jack Bogle. We're both reading that just now. So that, you know, that's pretty good. And it offers very clear, accessible sort of history of index investing, but also lots of great data, which just shows very starkly how active fund management routinely underperforms. And people need to read that stuff, because it still surprises me how many people I speak to just don't know how much money has been wasted in financial markets on expensive fund managers who don't beat the market.
That's a good book following this conversation. Absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining our show. It has been like, I just looked at the clock. I was like, whoa, we have talked for more than an hour. Time flies.
Thank you very much.
It's been exciting.
It's been very interesting. And we hope that maybe we can invite you back when you've published your book.
That would be awesome.
Lovely.
So looking forward to meeting you guys again, and have a nice day. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.